Hello and welcome to a very special PGA Merchandise Show edition of the Forward Press Podcast presented by GolfWeek.com. I'm your host, David Dusek, and this week my very special guest is John K. Solheim, the president of Ping Golf. I had a chance to chat with John at Ping's world headquarters in Phoenix, Arizona a few weeks ago, and as you're about to hear, we talked about a lot of different things. We talked about what it's like to be the third generation in the Solheim family to be running Ping Golf. We talked about what it was like back in the day to be hanging out with his legendary grandfather, Carsten Solheim. And I talked to John about designing golf clubs and then running Ping Japan. Then finally, what it was like to come back to the United States and be named president of Ping. We also talked about the USGA and the RNA's distance reports, which are expected to be coming out very soon now. It was a very fun conversation. I had a good time with it, and I think you're going to really enjoy listening to it. Get stronger, hit longer, and end pain with Golf Forever. Created by Justin Leonard and co-author of the Younger Next Year Back book, Dr. Jeremy James, Golf Forever is the take anywhere online golf fitness program that helps you build a body primed for golf. It's simple, safe, and it works. At home, in the gym, on the golf course, Golf Forever's easy to follow exercises, warm-up routines, and course management videos will help you play your best pain-free. Sign up today at golfforever.com and use promo code GOLFWEEK for a free 14-day trial. So I'd like to welcome to the Forward Press Podcast, John K. Solheim. John is the president of Ping Golf, and welcome, John. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Wake up. Come on. That coffee's got to kick in. This is real entertainment here for people. So we're here in Phoenix. We're in the one of the boardroom. Is there a name for this boardroom here at the Ping headquarters?
I would say we call it a conference room, and we do not have an official boardroom. But we're working on that.
Boardrooms are cool. I mean, if you get that nice long table, maybe, you know, the beverage station at the end, the pretty view. You've got lots of pretty views here in Phoenix. You could have a good boardroom situation here.
Yeah, we spend all our money on better drivers and don't have a great boardroom. But we're working on that.
Well, that's something.
Try to get both.
Something to work on. So how's business been? We're coming to the end of your third year as the president. I think it was the beginning of 2017, if I'm not mistaken. So 17, 18, 19 is three. How's business
right.
going?
Yeah. This has been a good year for us. So yeah, I don't want to brag too much and ring too many alarms. But Ping's having a good year, having a good year around the world. So it's been nice to see. In the past we've kind of seen pockets of success here and there, but we've kind of got running on all cylinders around the world.
How challenging is it to have all things running all around the world, to have everything sort of clicking from a business standpoint? And we're going to get into some of your background and what it takes, but there's different markets out there. The American market, you're obviously very aware and up to speed with the Japan market, the European market. There's lots of different things that are out there, and they don't always want the exact same thing at the same time, do they?
No, that's truly the case. And yeah, I would say for a long time, we've had good success in the U.S., great success in Europe, not so much in Asia. Just in recent years, we've started to have a lot more success in Asia. So how hard now that we're actually kind of getting there, it seems actually to work in sync together or whatever. Isn't like you have to master all these different skills. Definitely does put some challenges on the supply chain and just the manufacturing. In the past, we've always been able to move production from one location to the other just to help out if someone's, you know, having a really hot year. This year, everybody had a good year.
Good.
So it was just hard to find, you know, where to build those golf clubs and where to get those golf clubs.
Gotcha. Well, I want to go back a little bit because your background in this business is actually very unique within the world of golf. Your grandfather, Carsten Solheim, founded this company. Your father ran this company. And now, as I sort of said, this is the end of the third year with you as the president. Was there ever a time when you were growing up when you sort of didn't think this is going to be what you were going to do? Was there ever a period where, like, you know what, I like engineering, but I'm going to make bicycles? Or I'm going to do something else? Or was it sort of predestined that you were going to be in the family business?
I would say most all the time, this is what I wanted to do. Brief moment when I was graduating with my engineering degree, Boeing was coming in, hiring and doing interviews. And I thought about potentially
exciting.
Doing airplanes, but kind of golf sounded more exciting in the long run.
Did you grow up playing?
I did. Yeah, kind of on and off. Get real passionate about it, was a decent junior player, and then kind of would burn out pretty often as well too, and take a year off and then get
fall
the
back
itch
in
again.
Love with it.
Yeah,
gotcha. And Tell me a little bit about what golf was like around the house with you guys, because a lot of people try and keep their vocation and their avocation separate, but with your family, and I found with a lot of people in the world of golf, it becomes your job. It becomes something that is always around. It's always on TV. Was golf around your house, or did your parents actively sort of try and separate family from golf, which happened to be the business?
No, I mean, so golf was always there. We did vacations around, you know, work trips with my dad or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there was always some golf tournament going on, or accounts to visit, or distributors to see. Mm-hmm. So golf was always there. I would say a little different. We weren't one of these like superstar golf families where they play a lot of golf. We definitely played golf as a family, mm-hmm. like growing up, but you know, none of us really reached that super high caliber of golfer. And, you know, there's a lot of these families out there that just seem to turn out really good golfers. So we weren't that case, but we were definitely, you know, into the business side of it. Played a decent amount of recreational golf growing up with the family. And then, you know, watched a lot of tournaments and stuff on TV on the weekends.
What was your sort of first official job with Ping?
I don't know if you'd call it official, but when I was in high school, I would come in like in the summers as an mm-hmm. intern. So the first job I did doing that, I actually spent on a computer kind of back in the 2D CAD days. Mm-hmm. And so we were going from, we had all paper drawings to actually putting them into the computer. So I was just taking paper drawings for mostly equipment that we used to build golf clubs
yep.
and drawing those into the computer so we'd have them.
So you were taking archival stuff, not things that
were... Yeah, now those archives I created are totally obsolete. I don't even think we could open those files if we try it anymore. So
it's just another summer well spent by, you know, John Solheim. That's fantastic. Did it seem like tedious work at the time, or because you liked that kind of stuff and maybe that's how your brain liked you, it was something that appealed to you?
I liked the CAD stuff. I liked learning how to do the CAD stuff. So a lot of it was, you know, just copying stuff, but then mm-hmm. I did take some time and like draw up some putters. Mm. 3D was just coming on then, so I did learn the 3D and designed a few putters. I wouldn't say I finished them off, but later that after, so I worked the summer, and then some engineers kind of took what I started, finished it off, and actually became putters that we launched.
Did you work here during the summers when you were at ASU? Because you went as an undergrad, you were in mechanical engineering at ASU?
Yeah, so I started at Oklahoma State, ended up at ASU.
Okay, and so were you working here over the summers?
Yeah.
Now, what departments were you working in at that time? Was it in engineering, or did you sort of early on dabble in all different kinds of phases of the business and of the operation?
So mostly engineering. I did probably two summers with Karsten as his assistant.
That
so
must have been fun.
That was a blast. That's probably where I learned the most. That was
I bet.
Following him around, got to travel with him. He mm-hmm. did do some trips that I didn't go on, so then I'd kind of go back to engineering, did a little bit in repair and the production side mm-hmm. of things. But learned a ton from him, just kind of walking the campus. Just really interesting how he ran the company, kind of looking into how it runs now. And I don't recall him really ever having any like scheduled meetings. And that's what I'm just trying to figure out. How do I get these meetings off my calendar?
Yeah.
Somehow he figured it out. And he would just kind of walk around. He'd have the occasional meeting, I think. But most of his stuff, he came in that day, found something that was going wrong. And we spent the whole day deep diving into that. And by the end of the day, it was fixed because the day didn't end.
Right. Until something was fixed.
Yeah.
So even as the company grew over time, would it be appropriate to say that he kept it in his mind as a small business? I mean, he started it out of a garage. It was a home business. It starts with putters. But as the scale increases, as the number of, you know, the campus gets bigger, did he still treat it in his mind like a small family business?
That's a good question. I would say he would answer that it grew much bigger than he ever expected. So he realized it had turned into a big business. But the way things ran, it was still, he was the decision maker on mm-hmm. just about everything. And that's what I was shocked is, you know, we had so many people around the company working in all these things, but, you know, they really all turned to Karsten on what are we going to do here? What are we going to do there? And it was just interesting to me, you know, they were all like in engineering, there were all these degreed engineers. And they were waiting for direction from Karsten on, you know, the next driver. You know, how do we proceed? How do we tackle this problem?
That's leadership. I mean, that's just another sort of form of leadership and respect to him, because obviously the people who were designing Ping clubs at that point knew this guy knew what he was talking about. I mean, he may not have had, in some cases, you know, backgrounds on drivers or this or that, but I would imagine that everybody deferred because they knew the guy had made clubs, right? I
mean, yeah, for sure.
So when do you sort of officially become an employee, if there was ever a time, at Ping?
Graduated in 1996 in like December, and the way our vacation used to work, you had to start before the end of the year. So my dad's like, you gotta come in before, you know, we had a Christmas holiday. So I think I started.
So you showed
on
up
like
for the Christmas party,
December,
basically.
December 22nd, I'm guessing. Worked one day to get that day in, so then I would actually get 2 weeks vacation like the following week or whatever.
So your dad couldn't swing 2 weeks vacation? I mean, like,
now we actually get pretty clever, and if we, you know, bring someone in, we can actually offer a little more vacation.
Wow.
And stuff like that. But yeah, back in those days, it was, everything was very seniority.
I would have thought
based.
There was more perks to the job. I mean, come on, you've got the
right
last name.
No, I wasn't highly
here.
Recruited or anything like that, so I didn't have covered parking. I didn't. So yeah, all back then, everything was seniority based. We've gone a little bit now where we can offer like covered parking and
which out here in July, covered parking is probably as coveted as it gets.
It's a big deal.
So what's the first club officially then after your one day? What's the first club? Because you then start in engineering, correct?
So then, yeah, I started as an engineer, designing putters.
What's the first putter that you really got your hands
kind
into?
Of the Isopure putter family. So our first insert putter was kind of my first project.
And what was that like? If you look back on it now, how did you do with that project?
So we did. It was very successful. We had seen a downturn in our putter business. And that was, you know, we had some competitors come out there with insert putters at the time, so that had a softer feel, softer sound. So this was our answer to that, and it went over very well in the marketplace. Now, with that said, it's just comical, I'll say kind of the lack of testing we did compared to what we do now.
That's what I was sort of getting to.
The ringers.
Is that?
Oh, we learned everything on the fly. And I remember like going in at 4 a.m. the day we were first going to start cutting these on the milling machine. And I remember I get there at 4 a.m. like, hey, I'm ready to see these. And the guy's like, what are you doing here so early? We're not going to start cutting these till 8. He's like, we got to set them up and do all this and all that. And I'm like, okay, I'm really tired, but I'll just stay here.
Can I be right back with a cup of coffee and sit here and look at this piece of metal that from 4 hours from now they're going to start.
But then, we learned on the, because we were cutting production parts. You know, now we do all these pilot runs, test samples, do all these tests, make sure we have it right before we go to production. But back then it was basically, we went straight from a design to a mold to running production parts and kind of learning on the fly.
Hey, ever hear about the ex-football star who robbed a Brinks truck, then tucked $400,000 under his arm like a football and escaped using an inner tube? No? Then you'll want to listen to season one of The Sneak, a podcast by For the Win and USA Today Sports. Here, take a quick listen to the man who actually pulled that off.
In 2008, a former D1 football star pulled off a robbery so daring and so strange that it went viral worldwide. It was a perfect crime story. There was just one problem. It wasn't the real story of what happened. The Sneak is a new, serialized true crime podcast from For the Win and USA Today Sports. You can subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or get it anywhere you get podcasts on Tuesday, January 14th.
So I have this idea in my head that you can either tell me is true or is not true, but every engineering department sort of almost seems to have a group of people that are working on stuff that is really theoretical and potentially is stuff that's going to be 5-7 years down the line. Probably has a lot of things that will never come to fruition, never be implemented, but we just are trying to learn stuff. What does this do? What does that do? Is that the most fun job in engineering, or are the guys who actually and the ladies who actually work on stuff that goes into pro shops and into green grass stores, is that the job that you want because you can actually see the product?
I think it depends who you ask, because I would definitely have my pick, but I see guys and gals, you know, moving to different departments that I would be like, that doesn't sound more interesting to me, but they do that. So
just the way their brain works, it sort of appeals to them.
Yeah, we've got guys that have been doing design, and they go into manufacturing engineering. So then now they're working on, you know, how do we build these things? How do we improve the quality? Which to me, I'm more about, you know, what's the next design going to be like?
Yep.
would probably be my pick of, you know, I like to design and actually see that product that I actually did out in the marketplace.
Yep.
But we got guys, and we call it the innovation department, that are working on that stuff 5 years out. And, you know, their exact concepts probably never actually make it to the production floor,
mm-hmm.
but they put a lot of, you know, they kind of, they measure themselves in how many like concepts get into products.
How many patents that they have their name on, or they have their, was there ever a product that you worked on, and now that we're maybe separated out from it, you can be like, that should have been bigger. Like there was something about this driver or this putter or iron or something that you were involved with where as you're making it, you're like, oh, this is going to be really cool. Like this, what we're doing here is going to really help people. And then for whatever reason, they didn't get it, or it didn't catch on the way that you thought it should have. Grant your enthusiasm for it.
Yeah. I mean, I would actually say not product wise, nothing's coming to me. I feel actually like the marketplace is really good at identifying what product works and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You can fool them for a few months or whatever and spike some sales, but eventually they catch on. I would say what we've done in fitting, like with InFlight, an InFlight Motion, which was mm-hmm. a device that we just put on the shaft and three swings could fit you to the right shaft.
I remember seeing that for the first time at the PGA show about 4 years ago or so now and being like, this is big.
Yeah, so both those I was very excited about. Still, I'm very proud with the work we've done to that.
Yep.
But didn't take off in the marketplace. And I think both of them, we were just a little ahead of our time. We've seen kind of the launch monitor companies catch up and apply some of the stuff that we had in InFlight to their software now.
Yep.
And it's and part of it might be just fitting is more brand agnostic a lot of the times.
I think a lot of people are looking for that. Yeah, I think that
so
the business is...
when we kind of say this is Ping, they think they're only...
You're going to get a favoritism towards it because you guys came out with a really clever putting device that was essentially a clamp that would go onto the shaft of a putter, and then you would take your smartphone. And this is now going back probably more like 5 or 7 years.
Well, that one we still have. That one still lives on.
Which to me was amazing because it would show you the dynamics of your stroke. It would make recommendations about the general type of putter that you wanted, one that had a strong arc, a slight arc, or a relatively straight back, straight through motion. And it didn't know whether it was attached to a Ping putter or not. So the consumer could buy that product, use the app, and learn about the quality of their stroke and measure improvement over time.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, it's you're creating a training aid. But at the same time, to be able to gather data, I mean, that part of the world of golf, in my mind, has really exploded over, say, the last 3 or 4 years. And I'll get into a little bit about what you're doing with Arcos in just a little bit. But the whole concept of data and analytics and its effect on building golf equipment is just, it seems like, you know, there's no reason not to employ that stuff if you have the data, and you guys have been collecting it for a long time.
Yeah, for sure. To me, the quality of data drives better product and can drive better golf for, mm-hmm. the golfer if they actually know the data and they can make adjustments to their swing or just to their game. I would say I've seen that where we used to, on our range, one, we used to have basically people out there with the construction gear. Every time a ball landed, they wouldn't plot the stick
like
down there.
Surveying, yeah.
And we would survey the distance to how far the shot went, how far right, left.
Yep.
And it was all Ping Man, mechanical man based. And mm-hmm. then we actually put a sonar system onto the range. So when a ball landed, we had all these microphones out on the range that would triangulate to where the ball landed.
Based on the sound waves that are created by the moment of impact.
Yeah, so we can track that.
Wow.
Great system. Broke down quite a bit on us. You'd always have a microphone out.
Would it work in the rain?
No. and other stuff could set it off, like if there were loud noises and stuff like that.
Oh, my gosh.
But then launch monitors came along and really improved the data we could get. And then we got... that enabled us to do a whole lot more player testing, because in the past you couldn't really, with the sonar you could kind of get player testing data, but it was hard because you didn't know where they were starting from as much. You had to input all that sort of thing.
Yep.
But with launch, now we've got spin, now we've got ball speed, we've got
everything, right? You've got everything.
And I would say the one thing we don't have right now that we are looking to get is more, the difference between a range shot and then on course data.
Well, that's
what
the next
leap, on the
right?
Range,
I mean, you've heard, players for generations say that I can't get my range game, to the first tee. And you've got a system here called Enso, which is a very sophisticated system that tracks, basically using super high-speed cameras, a player as they swing, and you can get all kinds of data. What was it like asking? I would imagine that probably came out of the R&D department wanting to get stuff. Who got to tear the check for that? And was that a fun request putting in? Because I would imagine that's not cheap. and hey, we want to buy this.
I can't even remember how much it costs.
It's probably best that you not
all
remember.
Come from the same place, so it, to me, it doesn't really matter. Everybody's always worried about whose budget it goes on, and I'm like, at the end of the day, it's all coming
it's
from the same bank account.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't matter that much. We've definitely spent more money on other things than that, but that wasn't cheap. But you know, that one we could definitely see the benefit into it right away. A lot of these other technologies, you don't know as much what you're going to get to be able to capture
that data. To me, that one, when I saw it a few years ago, was really interesting. And now I know that you bring players in. I just saw Victor Hovland was in here fairly recently, and you guys put his swing up on social media that was taken there to be able to get. You know, that, if I'm not mistaken, that system was originally designed to track missiles or something like that. Am I mixing that up? It was the speed of those cameras.
I've never heard that one. This sounds really cool, though.
It does. Well, if I'm going to make something up, make it sound cool.
Yeah, it was done with Fujikura kind of started it.
I remember they were the first ones who had it.
Yeah, and so we actually worked with them to get it. And then we've kind of taken what we got from them and added to it and kind of customized it for our needs. And then we are actually looking at, like, some of the short we can't do left-handed right now. So we're looking at, you know, how can we broaden it to...
You realize, you know, my son is left-handed, right?
I've got a daughter that's left-handed, too.
He's mad because he's not allowed to play shortstop or third base. I mean, he's 15, and you know, it's just not... It's either pitching first base or he's in the outfield, which he's fine with. But, yeah, the left-handers always seem to get the short end of the stick. At some point after you were vice president of engineering... was there ever a time when you're sort of looking around saying like, okay, like I see this path in front of me? At that point, you're 43 now? 44?
45.
45. We're both getting older. Did it sort of become obvious like what the next decade might be for you once you'd sort of reached that part? Because at that point, you've worked your way up the food chain within the engineering department. You're building lots of clubs. Ping's having a lot of success. Was there a point where you sort of, I don't want to get all existential on it, when you sort of sat back like, okay, this is it. I can sort of see how this is maybe going to work out for me and how it's going to work out for the company.
Boy, like looking 10 years out, I would never say I've had extreme confidence on anything that far out. Stuff just changes so quick. Definitely seen, like, to me, Turbulators was a great example where we got those tests in, and I'm like, we never see that. You know, we've just picked up a mile and a half of club head speed, like, for free, which, you know, translates to even more ball speed.
Well, I guess that's
so
what I'm really,
like,
what I'm really talking about.
So to me,
like,
those initial tests, and to me, I'm like, yeah, this is a technology that's going to stay around. It's not going to be a.
Well, I was really sort of getting it for you personally. I mean, at some point, like you had said that you always sort of knew that you would be involved in the business, and you know, with your father at the point being the president of the company, there had to have been talks at some point around that's like, yeah, you know, at some point, I could see that you would maybe doing that. Had this talk of you at that point been or had been addressed that you might go to Japan? I mean, which is something I wanted to get into now, but. Almost training you to and sort of grooming you, if you will. You're a person. People shouldn't be groomed for anything like that. But
yes and no. I mean, so like we talk, but I mean, we don't have a whole lot of long, in-depth conversations about the whole succession plan.
Would it be weird
like that? Well, potentially it could happen and not be weird, but we make it weird. So they're very short, succinct. I had actually proposed. So we were doing some succession planning and kind of basically we got tasked to present to Doug Hawk and my predecessor and my dad, you know, kind of here, what's your plan for your future? And I did that. And in there, I put, you know, I think it would be great to go to Japan. Anyway, I did that. And I didn't hear anything for like, you know, for like 2 years on it. And
really?
Then kind of one family meeting we were having, my dad said, I think I need to go to Japan. Now, I kind of think... There was a lot of tension between us back then. He was just looking for a break, and with a positive side or whatever. So, but to me, it was a genius move on his side to give me that break. Let me go learn.
Yep.
Without kind of his consistent oversight or whatever.
So, what's it like when you then tell your wife, because you've got a growing family just starting out at that point, like, hey. We're going to the other side of the world, and I don't know if either of you spoke the language at that point, but...
we still don't speak the language or whatever.
Culturally, I mean, you're going to someplace that's, you know, is far away as you're almost going to get from, I mean, there are a lot of conveniences in modern things, but Japan's a lot different than Phoenix.
Yeah, so, that conversation was easy. We kind of knew, we're in a family business. We're in Phoenix. We're not moving anywhere. Phoenix mm-hmm. is great. Have no problem spending the rest of my life here, but do you want to spend your whole life here?
Mm-hmm.
We saw it as a great opportunity to get several years outside of Phoenix. Good chance for, we've got four kids, get the kids.
Just their like whole global Phoenix awareness and just, their sense of, is great. What did they think about the idea?
They were all excited. Yeah. So no one really flinched at the idea or anything. Everyone was kind of all in. We actually moved over a Christmas break. So mm-hmm. it was kind of in the middle of a school year, and it was.
Did you have to get one day?
Within 2 months we were actually gone.
Did you have to get the one day in pig in Japan to sort of qualify for the vacation plan or something?
You know what? It was the same deal at the end of the year. I showed up for the company party. Actually, there it's different because now you're worried about taxes and stuff.
Right.
So I didn't have any work. So I need to be clear on that because I don't want anybody going back.
No.
I didn't work at all. But I before the first of the year. But I did. They did have a company Christmas party that I went to.
That's cool.
And then it was kind of right after the first of the year.
So how is the Japanese market for golf different from the market here in the United States?
It's completely different and really similar in a lot of ways. So that clears it up. So that's the tricky thing. I would say finding a strategy that worked for us. I would say we were going down a path of we were trying to act like we were Japanese over there, and I think the consumer just saw through it that we weren't. We were
interesting
at that point. I think we'd been over there for about 6 years doing it as our own. In the past, it had all been distributors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just kind of saw through it that, hey, you guys aren't really, we were doing gold product and stuff like that. And they were just kind of like, you guys and
you don't get it.
Japanese. And we were charging, a whole lot for it. And so when I got there, I kind of said, I think we need to kind of go to our roots. We're an American company,
mm-hmm.
But we need to speak Japanese. So we need to market in their language and, you market their tour players mm-hmm. and things like that. So they get us. But at the end of the day, they understand we're an American brand that has success all around the world, and we're here in the Japan market.
So I would guess that the timing was just right on that. Obviously, you're trying to match up your marketing and the way that you're going to present the company to that market in the appropriate way. But for a while, I think in the U.S., people who were really into golf equipment almost looked at Japanese stuff as being made to a higher quality or made to a really exacting standard. And not that the American stuff wasn't really good, but they held the Japanese stuff in the Asian market in a different light. And starting, I would argue, just under a decade ago, maybe things flipped around, where the American product seemed to have more innovation to it, a little bit more technology was put into the American product. And if you then present that, speaking Japanese as an American company, it seems like that's the perfect recipe. Now all of a sudden you're able to do that if the Japanese consumer is willing to buy American product. Is that fairly accurate? Or was the timing
apparently the timing has worked out well because we have done very well in Japan for the mm-hmm. last 5-6 years just with steady growth and continuing to gain market share. I think that it does kind of ebb and flow where, there's times where, there are people that see the Japan product as superior and mm-hmm. the U.S. product as superior. I think the Ping product's superior, but that's just the right opinion.
Yeah.
And to me, it's just kind of balancing that. I would say, Japanese market super focused on the cosmetic quality of the
yes.
product. So
they're, yes.
They get a club and they hold it up right up to their head.
Really inspect it.
And inspect that for any blemishes. American customer, kind of grabs it by the grip, takes a few waggles at it. So they're looking at it from 4 or 5 feet away.
Yeah.
And seeing what that club looks like to them. Mm-hmm. So just little things like that are different. And so obviously in Japan, you see a huge focus on the cosmetic quality. In the U.S., it's more about, what's it swing like? What does it feel like? And things like that.
It's interesting. So with the Olympics going to Japan in August, what will that mean for the Japanese golf market and golf in Japan?
Good question. I think it... the Japan has a very strong golf market.
Well, it's an established market. It's been around for over 100 years.
So I think they'll get good participation at it. I think all the players will want to play it in this year.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think they'll get good attendance to people, coming out and watching mm-hmm. the golf tournament. We've got a couple girls on the Japan LPGA that I'm pretty confident they will represent the Japan team, and they're really good. So I'm really excited to see what they do over there.
Mm-hmm.
They've done really well this year. Ai Suzuki won the money list. Shibuno won the stat title and won the British Open this year. So we've had some great success over there, and mm-hmm. they have some really big fans. So I think for us, the Olympics is going to be really big mm-hmm. with in the Japan market with those players representing Japan.
You're being really generous with your time, and I don't want to take too much of it. So there's really two more topics that I'd like to bring up with you. The first is that we're expecting the USGA and the RNA to release their findings on their big distance report. Every year we get the annual report that we sort of know about, which is basically just a culling of all the data, and this is the driving distance average on the PGA Tour and the European Tour and the ladies European Tour, etc. That one we all know about, but we're still waiting for the report to come out that is basically going to show what the USGA and the RNA have been collecting data on. They spent a good part of 2018-19 collecting data from all different sources, manufacturers, golf course architects, golf course operators, etc., trying to find out the effect of distance. We don't know, obviously, what they're going to say, but and I'm not going to ask you, what did Ping sort of have a say? Did you guys write a letter? Did anybody present stuff? I mean, I would imagine that you've got an important voice in this conversation. What did Ping have to say?
Yeah, I mean, over the years, we've written a lot of letters. I would say our kind of standard stance is, you know, the laws of physics are really good at kind of dictating mm-hmm. how far the ball should go. Kind of the requirements they've put on equipment, it really just added a lot of cost and complexity to golf equipment today, because they're kind of these just arbitrary levels of, you know, things like a CT measurement that mm-hmm. are just get tricky to monitor. And then they've kind of changed the rules on, you know, whether now if the CT raises over time. It used to be you couldn't play a club out of conformance.
Right.
Now they're deeming that club broken. So to me, there's a lot there. I think at the crux of the issue is we've got some really good golfers that spend an inordinate amount of time working on swing speed, working on hitting the ball farther, and they mm-hmm. do hit the ball quite a bit farther, much further than the average golfer.
Sure.
I think the average golfer out there, you know, they're doing everything they can to gain a couple yards, and they're not going out shooting under par every time they play. So the game has not gotten too easy. It has not gotten too short for 99% yeah. of the golfers. For that top, you know, to me, it's like saying the runners are running too fast. What can, because they keep breaking all the world records. It's just the way kind
of... There's this sort of evolutionary process that happens throughout sport. And whether it's runners, as you mentioned, you know, there was, you know, people are coming close to the 2-hour marathon. I know that one was actually done with a lot of assistance.
Yeah.
The way that basketball, for example, is played, you know, you get guys like Steph Curry hitting more 3-pointers than Larry Bird would have attempted in a season, you know, by a lot, you know, 30 years ago. Football, there's analytics in that. The games are just played differently. The athletes are different.
That's a big point. Like, the new stats that are available really kind of open golfers' eyes to how important distance is. Where, you know, it used to be everything's about putting or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And putting's still important. But really, it showed how distance off the tee is a big advantage to golfers.
Ball striking travels. I mean, I've talked to a lot of players and I've talked to a lot of coaches about this. And, you know, guys... Anybody can have a hot week of a putter, but if you're somebody whose average distance off the tee is, say, 285, you're not going to show up and start hitting at 320 one week and then go back to 285. That's just not how the game works and not how the human body works. And that maybe for a while we undervalued quality ball striking and big hitting. To me, what's interesting is it's deemed to be really virtuous and good to be an outstanding putter, and that we as a sport, or at least the governing bodies, give me the impression that they like it when people are really good at putting, but they don't give the same virtuousness or the same level of respect to people who can drive the ball at the most elite levels. So when Jordan Spieth or Jason Day or some of these guys putt lights out and they have, you know, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9 strokes gained putting, so they're really, really, you know, they're holding everything. That's deemed to be, or seems to be, a better thing. We can reward that and we're happy with that more than, oh, wow, Tony Finau gets 0.9 with driving distance. It's almost like, well, Tony Finau is 6'5". The guy's made out of rubber bands. It's not a fair fight. Which to me is, why do we have this bias?
I think that's a great point. Yeah, I don't know. Because the guys that hit it far, it's not like
You know how hard it is to control the club head speed? I mean,
I think keep it on the planet when you're hitting it that far.
When you're swinging at 123, 124 miles an hour, to be able to align the club face sort of towards the fairway on a plane that will make it go into the fairway, ideally, that's really hard. And I think that there's an underappreciation for what that is. And I'm not just saying that because I'm in, you know, the headquarters of a golf equipment manufacturer. I've said this one and written it numerous times. I just think it's an underappreciated skill. What's going to be coming out new for Ping Golf in 2020? Now that we're here, talk to me a little bit about some of the things, the products that people should be looking out for. What are going to be the hot things from Ping in 2020?
So to kick off the year, we've got two new product lines. So we have our Hepler putter line. It's a solid face putter. So kind of to complement the Sigma 2 putters that we have right now that have an insert, very soft face on those. So the Hepler line has a solid face, kind of a two-tone copper and black look. So very attractive putters. Oh, I don't even remember, 8 or 9 different models in there. So we've got all sorts of different stroke types in there. We've got the adjustable length in there. So all these putters can be fit to any individual. So really good performing putter line. And we also have our new G710 iron. It's a hollow body, super forgiving iron. So a distance iron, very forgiving. Going to be really good for probably a mid to higher handicap, slower swing speed that's looking to maximize some distance with their irons. You know, have more 7 irons hitting in rather than 5 irons.
Sounds good.
So it's good for that. And then I'm excited. These also will have a Arcos as standard on them in the grip. So the consumers will get an opportunity to test that out and then sign up for the service. And that's where I taught the next generation stats. It's really helped my golf game. In a little over a year in Arcos and just seeing huge improvements in my handicap and my scoring ability just by being able to go back and look at historical data, where am I missing it?
Tendencies and things, it's huge.
So I was able to refit myself, kind of realized that I didn't, you know, I was pulling all my irons. So I was able to refit my irons to get me lining up straight and then just finding gaps in my distances. So I really think that's going to be a big value to the consumers is being able to see that data and also help us design better products for them in the future.
Because for people who may not be 100% aware, Arcos is a system that essentially links each one of your golf clubs, whether it's a screw-in tab or sometimes they have the technology built into the grips. It will wirelessly connect to your smartphone. There are other ways that you can sort of link it up. And the system can detect when you're hitting each of your shots and then using the GPS system, tell and sort of superimpose. Basically, think of putting a thumbnail print in at the tee of every hole that you play. I think they've got 40,000 different courses that are all mapped up using basically Google Maps. And it plays a game of connect the dots. And what's really interesting is all of a sudden it can take that data and tell you that not only did you hit, you know, 8 fairways out of 14, it can tell you your tendency is to miss left on approach shots, that your tendency is to come up short, that your most consistent clubs, for example, are whatever they are, that your average distance with each of your clubs, which is hugely important. I think that people who use this all of a sudden become aware that they have major gaps in their setups, whether there is a gap between their pitching wedge and their, you know, that may come with their iron set or the and their next wedge, if it's a gap wedge or whatever, or at the top of their bag, if they carry one fairway wood and then they go into a hybrid, that the gap can be 30 or 40 yards sometimes at the elite levels. Just the awareness that this gives you, it changes the way that you play golf. Basically, it's just, you become so much smarter and make better decisions on the golf course.
The way it's basically shot link for the average guy. So right now shot link's not on Korn Ferry. It's not on the LPGA. It's only on the PGA Tour in the US. And those guys use it heavily. A lot of them have stat guys that are analyzing their data. And this Arcos brings that to everybody. So to me, what's nice is it not only gives you like the old school stats, like greens and regulation. You might think you're a horrible putter because you had three putts that round. But it'll actually tell you, no, it was just because you were hitting the ball to
your
50
ball striking
feet
put you in a position
time.
Where your putting
it's actually
couldn't
approach, or even your chipping is bad. And you've just put yourself in positions where even tour players three putt from.
Yeah, if you're going to be 70 feet away with your first putt, there's a better than, you know, and you're a 15 handicap player, you're going to three putt. And if you don't, you probably just did something really, really well. So congrats. I know you've got to run here. I appreciate you giving me so much time. John, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David.